This is fun! The FU Network!
Kneel before Zod!
Hi, I'm Neil Wadewitch. Welcome to the Zodcast. It has been a while. I find myself still drained by the 2019 election campaign. Drained by the negativity. Drained by the division. Drained by the misinformation and fake news. Drained by Canadian media that has failed us again and again. Drained by a political class that was only too happy to sell fear in the place of realistic policy. The truth is, I haven't had much to say. I haven't been able to process what the lessons from the recent election were. I knew it was at stake. I was aware of the possible consequences of a Conservative victory. We have seen it play out in Ontario and Alberta recently. I haven't been able to find a path forward since Election Day. I have this uneasy feeling that nothing was actually settled on October 21st. We have a Conservative Party of Canada that doesn't appear to realize the election is over. It is in permanent campaign mode now, and I'm not sure if it's to distract from the weak and soon to end leadership of Andrew Scheer, or do Conservative governments in Canada have no intention to work together with other political parties to find the solutions that we require? Or are they entirely so devoid of new ideas that the permanent campaign is their only path to relevance and survival? How am I supposed to have sympathy for a political movement that views me as the enemy? I'm a pro-carbon tax. I'm a unionized and pro-LGBTQ rights liberal who believes that we need more immigration, not less immigration. I believe in pro-choice. I believe that climate change is man-made and it's the defining issue of our times. As well, how am I supposed to have sympathy for a province that is fighting for a way of life that is dead and buried? You can't fight evolution. The world is changing. You can choose to change and find growth in the new reality you face, or you can leverage national unity to create an evangelical petro-state in the middle of Canada. No amount of belligerent tough talk from Jason Kenney or the Wexit troglodytes hides the fact that they have no path forward other than to revert to the past. They have no plan. This isn't Back to the Future, it is fighting the future. If there's one lesson that history has taught us, it is that the world will move on with you or without you. So here we are at the end of 2019, with 1 month left in this decade, and I feel that I have more questions than I have answers. It's not where I thought I would be at this point. The only hope for us is to find these answers together. All right, I'll just get started. To introduce my next guest, I don't want to fanboy too much, but I was introduced to the writing of Dave Medini and the music of the Rheostatics at the time when I was discovering more of the larger world and discovering my identity as a Canadian, not only as a Canadian, but also discovering Canadian arts and culture beyond the mainstream. And Dave, your music and writing largely helped me on that journey, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
I'm glad we could help, Neil.
So tell us what you're into. Tell us about the West End Phoenix and what you're up to these days.
Well, I'm playing Rheostatics are on tour. So we're playing, like two or three shows a week. So there's that, there's shows out of town and and grinding back into the city, and then, the next day it's pretty much all the newspaper all the time. We're in a subscription drive right now. So a lot of it is about reaching out to potential subscribers and sort of, trying to trumpet the achievements of our newspaper. We're in our third year. We started 3 years ago. We're the first new print newspaper started in North America in 2017. And so we remain relatively robust and growing, which is great. But there's always a subscriber behind a hedge or up a tree that we have to announce the newspaper to and try to draw to our hive. So those are the two things that are really occupying most of my time these days. But it's a good life.
What possessed you to start up the West End Phoenix?
I was in Yellowknife writing my latest book, which came out last fall, called Midnight Light. It's about the Northwest Territories in Yellowknife, and I wanted to write a city book about the North. fell in love with Yellowknife was when I was there for a literary festival in 2014 and discovered the newspaper, The Yellowknifer. So I thought that a good way of getting to know the city and the region in relatively short order was to work as a reporter, which I'd never done before. So I called The Yellowknifer and asked, really I just called them out of the blue and asked if I could embed with them or work with them for a summer. And they were more than happy to accommodate me. The great people up there. So I worked as a reporter for a summer, and then made 7 subsequent trips back to the region in the city because a writer that I became friends with was arrested by the RCMP for obstructing a police investigation. So I ended up having to cover his trial for the book, published the book, and then came back to Toronto and realized that the community press in the city had been destroyed by Metroland, the Toronto Star parent company that had bought all the community newspapers and basically drained them of any kind of content and made them glorified flyers. And I wondered if there was, you know, if there was a space for a community newspaper that you couldn't wait to read once it arrived on your porch every month, as opposed to kicking it into the blue bin. And so gathered a few friends around the table September 11th, 2016, I think, and sort of ferried the idea, and people were supportive. And I went door to door and sold 800 subscriptions before we printed a single newspaper. So I knew there was an appetite for it. And as print was sort of leaving our life, I kind of thought it was the perfect time to sort of start to reintroduce the medium. And we have subscribers who've never subscribed to a newspaper before. So yeah, that's kind of where the idea came from.
Do you see in the future a move back to more community-based newspapers like yours? I know in Peterborough that there are some friends of mine who are looking to, maybe it's just going to be a periodical type thing, but they're kind of openly discussing. And then I know the West End Phoenix is kind of a motivation for that. But have you noticed that across Canada or in cities that you visited?
The local press, the community press, is definitely an endangered species these days because of the amalgamation of a lot of community press and the sale, frankly, of a lot of community press to bigger publishing companies who have essentially contracted them. That said, the place of, I mean, Yellowknife is a great example. You know, even though they have their own set of challenges, it's that's what kind of really drew me to the project, was the fact that there was a thriving city/community newspaper in 2017 at a time when, you know, a lot of newspapers were going down. They were continued to thrive, and I think the model just has to be a little bit different. And I do think people are still there in our sort of our macro news cycle. There's a dearth of stories that speak directly to where we live and how we live in our communities. And I think local concerns are, you know, becoming more and more important in terms of how our lives and our activities and our the decisions that we make affect where we live. And and also in a city like Toronto, where especially the West End, where we're based out of, there are concerns in our neighborhoods that are germane to the concerns of really any neighborhood around the world, certainly in North America, in terms of development and education and policing and traffic and transit, and development in particular. The neighborhoods have changed a lot as the neighborhood has prospered. There's kind of been a rush to build, and there's been a wave of money and wealth, and that's altered the DNA of the neighborhood. And it's part of our job as the newspaper to kind of to address that, articulate it, and gauge it, read it, report on it. And that's part of what we do.
How has been, I guess, finding new talent, finding new voices been? Do you find they come to you, or are you out there kind of actively recruiting people?
It's kind of a bit of both. People do find us, but it's fun to get a chance to kind of dream up ideas for features in the paper and for recurring recurring themes and recurring features. You know, Mishimi, the hip hop artist, wrote our comic memoir, our music memoir, in comic form last year. We have Heidi Sopinka, who's who wrote the Dictionary of Animal Languages last year, which is a widely regarded, internationally published, beautiful poetic novel. Writes our Pet of the Month. Claudia Day, who wrote Heartbreaker, writes our Missed Connections every month. And even in instances like our December issue, which is an all-Indigenous issue, it was fun to kind of match writers to subject. Evan Redsky, who's an amazing musician here, is writing about his life touring North America with a punk band in the 90s. And so it's a bit of both. And one of the reasons we did want to start the Phoenix, and we knew the Phoenix would have some sort of air under its wings, was because there are, and I know this firsthand, there's a lot of writers and photographers and illustrators, but mostly writers sitting around not writing. There used to be so many more opportunities in media, in newspapers to write, and those just aren't there anymore. So we kind of knew that if we could just figure out how to support the paper through revenue, through patronage donations. And we have many donors, and they're incredibly engaged and supportive. And we knew if we kind of had that, we would have the creative element because people are just dying to work and dying to write. So really that's, content has been the least of our concerns. And we think we've produced a lot of amazing stuff. In fact, a poem by David Seymour was just named one of the best Canadian poems of 2019. It's in the new anthology. And Alicia Elliott's, best-selling Globe book was one of the anchor stories, a story about living at Bloor and Lansdowne while going to school here. And that's part of that collection as well. And so I think we continue to produce really beautiful literature, which was one of the main things that we wanted to do. And we pay all of our writers industry standards. So people who come to the paper and subscribe to it, 100% of their subscription dollars are going to support an editor, a writer, a photographer. We don't do it really any advertising. And we pay modest rent at the Gladstone Hotel on the second floor. So really, it's, you know, if you support the West End Phoenix, you're supporting that poet that lives in the end of your street, you know, the novelist that lives in your neighborhood. So it's really about nourishing, you know, the creative element where we live.
How have you found the transition from being a writer and a journalist to being a publisher?
Yeah, it's a little odd. I mean, really, and the publisher is kind of a fancy way of saying fundraiser, at least in my capacity. And that's largely how my days are spent. So it's been, you know, hey, it's been a learning curve, and it's been an interesting, you know, new discipline, I suppose. I met some extraordinary people through it, but I was, you know, Midnight Light was my 13th book. It took me 2.5 years to write, and a lot of a lot of travel to the north and stuff. And frankly, I felt like I was probably a little bit, the tank was a little bit empty in terms of, you know, putting my hands on another book and trying to figure out how that was going to work. So it's actually, being a publisher has kind of come at a good time for me, I think. And the truth of the matter is, you know, even when I'm gigging, you know, when you're on the road and you're gigging, you're really only busy. You're only playing, you know, 2 hours out of a 24-hour day. And the rest of it is travel, and the rest of it is sitting around waiting to play, honestly. So I'm good enough as a multitasker to be able to, you know, send out, you know, catch up on emails or do some, you know, patron donor engagement remotely. So that's kind of one of the things I've learned to do, I think, and I think I'm getting pretty good at it.
Do you find being on the road with the Radio Statics, are you able to kind of throw a little bit of promotion for the West End Phoenix into what you do with the band, or do you try and keep that separate?
Yeah, I think a lot of people sort of come to the paper partly, well, they did in the beginning as sort of Radio Statics supporters, and I think people did sort of trust in the paper a little bit because a lot of people realized that, running or being part of, you know, a Canadian independent rock band for 40 years sort of proves that I'm in it for the long game a little bit, and then I sort of know my way around, you know, a creative eccentricity, I suppose. So I think people would know that I would come to this paper, you know, I would tackle the project not lightly, and I would invest, you know, my heart and soul into it, because I've been doing that for several decades, you know, playing this kind of alternative band, I guess, for lack of a better term. But it's grown since then, and at shows I don't talk about the Phoenix at shows. I mean, I'll bring papers, you know, occasionally, give out at the merch booth or whatever, but I don't really feel that that's my pulpit. It's about the band, it's about the music, and the worlds are kind of divided in that capacity. That said, you know, if somebody comes to me as a fan of the band or a fan of the books, then I'll tell them what we're doing and ask them to subscribe.
Now back to writing though. My introduction to you was on A Cold Road. It was
right.
How long were you conceptualizing that book? I mean, what drew you into writing? Was it something that you always figured that you would do and you kind of developed into that? Or did you just decide, you know, on tour or off tour, just, I think the story needs to be told?
I was writing for the Star. I was writing a column for the Star. I think it was, I want to say 90, between 90 and 92. And, you know, I was cursed in a way with having to write a column twice a month, once every 2 weeks, opposite Pierre Burton in the weekend section of the Toronto Star. And I say cursed because I really found it, I was quite fraught with having to come up with, you know, ideas for your column and seeing, you know, just being measured against sort of the poise and elan and skill of a veteran columnist like Pierre Burton. It really sort of put me in my place. But because I had to come up with story with the meat of a column every couple of weeks, and because I was touring a lot, I ended up kind of drawing from those experiences playing and being out in Canada and the world playing. So I kind of thought, after I started to write a little bit about those travels and those places, that there kind of might be something there. And then I was asked by my editor at the weekend section to kind of blow up a column into a tour diary, which appeared on the front page of that section one Saturday. And I received a call from Paul Corrington's literary agent to ask if I'd ever thought of developing that into a book. And I did sort of look around, I realized that there weren't really books like that in Canadian literature or Canadian art, you know. Certainly in music, there were mostly the books that were out there. Canadian books were like, you know, How to Get Ahead in the Music Business, kind of really dry, boring kind of institutional text. There was nothing, there was no work that really conveyed the excitement, honestly, and the adventure of touring Canada and the peril and the loneliness and the electricity and all of that. So I knew a book like that hadn't been written. So once I was asked to kind of think about it, I knew it would be potentially kind of a valuable thing. And I know my publishers at M&S were suspicious, I think, even though they, you know, they commissioned the piece, the book, they were suspicious of it because they only produced, you know, paperback editions of the book right out of the gate. There was no hardcover on A Cold Road, because I guess they thought, you know, well, we'll just do couple thousand here and we'll sort of see how it goes. But it really kind of caught hold of the imagination of, you know, certainly the listening public and I think the greater kind of readership, Canadian readership, and people that were interested in music and books and literature and were drawn to that book. So it ended up being, you know, a hit, a bestseller, whatever, bestseller. It did well and stuff. So and it continues to remain in print. So yeah, I was just grateful also to tell the stories of the other, you know, over 65 musicians whose voices are heard in that book, other than my own and my own bands and the Tragically Hips, of course. So it was great to kind of honor them and tell their stories as well, because I don't think their stories really would have been told had they not been included in that book.
I found one of the things I found fascinating with that book was there was myself and friends of mine. We were in the process of transitioning our campus radio station from an in-house to an FM station at that time. And then on one end, I had my father, who was kind of a dad rock musician, one of the guys who retired and decided to start a band. And his experience reading the book and other musicians, they were so vastly different than ours as people who, weren't there during those times and may not have known some of those bands, but how different groups of people were able to find enjoyment in that book and find commonality with that. It was a really odd moment that I read the book. I gave it to my dad knowing that he would love it. And I found that, then his friends started buying copies of the book and then my friends started buying copies of the book. It was really an interesting experience because it's not a story that was told. And I find that with a lot of your books that you seem to explore a side of the Canadian experience that it might not be told. And I guess I'd be remiss to mention this because you do write very well about hockey, and I'm just wondering about your take on this whole, I guess, first how the Don Cherry situation has kind of morphed into what's happening with coaching right now and some of the stories and basically how that relates to how hockey may be viewed today by Canadians.
Just kind of looking back, you talk about trying to come up with ideas that are, stories that haven't been told before, ideas that haven't been used. Ryan Cooter played with the Rolling Stones for half a year, I think, and they asked him how he sort of fit into the, the musical firmament there, the layers of what the Stones did, and he said he just played in the spaces. And I think that's sort of true to the way I kind of conceive, my art is I try to create in the spaces. So I try to find the places that are unoccupied, partly. And that was certainly the case with my second book, Tropic of Hockey, which found me going around the world and playing the game. Very little of that. It's a hockey book, and there certainly have been before it had been countless hockey books written, but it was certainly, I think it was the first, hockey book written by a Canadian in which there was no hockey played in Canada. It was all abroad. I was in China, Transylvania, and the Middle East. And in light of Don Cherry and in light of the discussions and the kind of measuring hockey as, the domain of the wealthy and the white and the closed-minded, the insular, with leanings towards, tendencies towards racism, homophobia, and sexism and all that. I'm grateful that the space that Tropic of Hockey occupies is one that reflects a world of within the game that's not white. And so many of the characters in that book are from other places, whether it's the Arab kids in Dubai or whether it's the northern Chinese in Harbin. And so so I'm glad that I've been able to. That I've in my own way tried to reflect that space and tried to widen people's perceptions of the game as it exists beyond kind of a merely, wealthy white suburban enclave, which is where a lot of hockey does kind of live. And even last night, we played Queer, which is a song from Whale Music, which is about two brothers in Seminar in British Columbia, and one is the older brother's comes out as gay, and he's forced out of the town, and it's about the young brother sort of seeks vengeance on, the homophobic team in which he's playing against. And I think we've always, just tried to really kind of stand out for other elements of the game anyways. And Don, in as much as, I've been a fan of Don's in the past, and I certainly have always enjoyed his company, being with him at the hockey day. And I do think there are certain, things that Don stands up for that are important, to remember as just, as people living together, whether that's, the loyalty that, we you know, that we, and the goodwill that we want to, maintain within our community, and certainly among the people we love, there's, you know, there's just an element to Dawn that really holds up that, you know, that really, homogenous, closed-minded, homophobic and racist, just closed-minded. I don't really want to use those, people will judge on their own terms whether, you know, they want to use some stronger language, but just a real kind of a, just sort of a relatively narrow view of the world of hockey. And we've, you know, as a society, we've moved on. And I think as a sporting culture, which is always kind of lagged behind, it's time to play catch up and to get where we have to be as a society.
And in regards to, I guess, the stories that are coming out, you know, I guess kind of in a broader sense, right. Mike Babcock and coaches who are there, do you feel this is kind of a reckoning that has been, I guess, some time coming, you know, between the old school of hockey and the new school, I guess, of thinking?
Yeah, you've seen it in every other professional sport. You know, you've seen it in, you've seen it in certainly in baseball with sort of more progressive managers. And some will say, actually, the game is sort of suffering because of it, just the way the game is played. But nonetheless, it's moved on. And the same is true in football and the NFL with a kind of a more, well, you finally, you know, there are dominant black quarterbacks in the NFL. It's never been the case before. And it's even the game has changed. It's way more like the CFL than it's ever been. And, the NBA has been like that for a long time in terms of allowing their racialized superstars to speak about, you know, social issues and stuff. The NHL has really been a tortoise. Hopefully this is a kind of a wall coming down. Hockey has, there's an abusive climate to the culture. It's always been there. And the fact that we're talking about it is really important, and it probably is a reckoning. We'll see how far it goes.
So I guess we're coming up to the end of the year and in the last month of the decade, which when someone pointed that out to me, I had this absolute moment of panic. Because it's one of those moments where you have to kind of think back and, you know, what have I accomplished over the last 10 years? I guess when you think over the last 10 years, what do you think of? What would you list as your biggest accomplishments?
Honestly, I think, you know, being in a family with, two kids who are now teenagers and being able to kind of navigate through a creative life while continuing to kind of raise a family and make sure that they, you know, this, our kids were able to kind of grow up in a healthy environment, sort of a forward pointing environment, and that, you know, my wife and I were able to continue to do the things that we love to do, through lean times and being able to find ourselves at the end of the decade continuing to do what we love to do. I mean, you know, even with the Rios, you know, we were largely absent, through certainly the second half of that decade, and now we're active and probably in many regards sounding just stronger than we ever have. And so that's really lovely to think about that. I mean, kind of tough, really, you know, with the sea change and, you know, in the discipline that I work, you know, whether it's media or, you know, rock and roll or books, it's all a little bit different and continuing to change. And it's nice sort of still, you know, being, you know, at the heart of all of those things and continuing to produce and be creative. And that's always the artist's greatest fear, you know, that it's going to dry up or you're going to be found out or for some reason you're going to have to stop living in that dream, you know. And But it's been a lot of hard work, both kind of on the domestic and the creative front. Yeah, I'm grateful and happy to be talking to you about it right now. So that's all. That's good. We feel good. I think we feel good going into 2020. Knock wood.
Well, we're definitely grateful for everything that you give. You know, everything that your band has given. And one of the best compliments I could pay to a musician is that whenever we've gotten conversations about the Rheostatics, and they'd say, describe them. And I'd say, I can't describe the band. You just have to listen to it and come to your own conclusions. And yeah, I think that you're part of one of the most criminally underrated bands in Canadian history. Just my very, you know, unimportant opinion, but I want to thank you. Thank you for coming on the podcast. You're an amazing writer. I'm a huge fan of the West End Phoenix and an even bigger fan of your band. And, yeah, thank you for your time, Dave.
Thanks, Neil. It's been fun engaging with you on Twitter and stuff too. And yeah, keep up the good fight. And yeah, I'm happy to. Anytime you need anything, just don't hesitate to ask. Didn't know what happened. Look who's found you, someone. Look who stole you from your nest. Say death. November's calling lonely here. Not at home. I'm so happy I could make you happy. Introducing happiness. What do I owe you? Or do you owe me more? A better
All right. Well, I have Mo Amir of the amazing podcast Van Color on with me, and we're going to talk some stuff out. It's awesome to have
you. Yeah, we are. Neil, it's a pleasure, man, and welcome back to podcasting. So excited to have you back. You were on a bit of a hiatus there. I don't think FU politics or, you know, the Canadian podcasting landscape was the same. So it's nice to hear your voice and nice to have you back.
Well, it is great to be back. I to be honest with you, I found the whole election to be really highly tiring. And I don't know, I just found that at the end of it, you know, I said, I'm going to give myself a couple of weeks and just relax. And
good for you.
And then after a couple of weeks, I'm like, you know what? I still have no idea what I want to say. You know, there's a lot to say. I just don't know. I didn't know how I could add to the discourse or how I, you know, I still felt like a bit of a live wire after the campaign. And I wanted to be constructive in what I said rather than just coming on and, you know, the same takes as before the election and saying the same things.
Sure.
I wanted some time to just kind of get through it. And, you know, you offered to come back on. I'm like, boom, I'm back.
I'll be on anytime you want me on, Neil. I had so much fun the first time. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. I know that we might not agree on everything, but I think we always have a good constructive conversation. So I'm excited for that.
We don't have to agree with everything. And that's one of the things I like about FU politics is you can have a conversation with people that you sit kind of, you know, there may be a few degrees separating you on the political spectrum, but mm-hmm. generally you can have constructive disagreements on things. And that's what it's about. You know, I find sometimes in social media, a lot gets lost in translation and, you mm-hmm. know, you'll find yourself having a pitched battle over a matter of degrees. It's really quite weird. And it's one of those things I really haven't missed. I come on, I do my two or three tweets a day, and lately I've been a little bit more engaged though.
No, it's good to see you, man. It's great.
So we were a few things we thought we were going to discuss, and one mm-hmm. I find incredibly interesting, and that's kind of the idea of, I mean, it's one segues into the other, but the idea of what being a Canadian means.
Yeah.
And it's such a broad
question. It's a tough question.
Yeah. But I've been thinking a lot about it, and I, for myself, I seem to just have kind of ideas. And I guess maybe that is my idea of the kind Canadian identity, is there's no Canadian identity, that it's more of an idea. It's more of how I feel about being a Canadian. It's how I feel about where I live. But it's not like, you know, like with America, you know, America and the red, white, and blue and all of that. They have these, you know, life, liberty, freedom, and all of these tangible ideas. And I've been thinking lately that the idea of being Canadian is that it is whatever we want to make of being a Canadian, that there's no defined idea or Canadian idea. Maybe for some people there is, but I guess that's kind of what I've come up with.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, Neil. I don't know if we necessarily don't have an identity, but I think as a young country, our identity is still very much forming in Canada. And one thing we have to keep in mind is that Canada is a settler state. You know, it's a compromise between French settlers, English settlers, and of course, the indigenous peoples of this land. And something that's often forgotten is that between the 16th and the 19th centuries, First Nations were absolutely vital to Canada's European colonies, both in exploration and in the fur trade, or you can call that, you know, natural resource extraction. And the Métis population in Canada is largely a result of that cooperation in the fur trade. Now, I want to be really clear, this is not brushing aside the historical injustices done to First Nations people, but it's just pointing out that even as a settler state, the Indigenous population had a considerable role in the definition of Canadian identity. Now, if we want to look at that through an economic lens, what we see is that for most of our history, Canada has defined itself as a natural resource extractor. And even today, you know, oil and gas or energy is still a huge part of the Canadian economy and still creates a lot of friction within the Confederation itself. And that identity of farmers and miners and resource extractors, you know, has stayed with us. And now in modern times, not only do you have this economic model of Canada being challenged of who we are and what we are, but we have viewed ourselves as an inclusive multicultural state. And multiculturalism, which unfortunately for a fringe population in this country, is becoming a bad word, but it's embedded in our policies. And we're proud of that. We have been proud of that. Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of this country, said as much in 2015 when he said that Canada is the first post-nation state. And we are a post-nation state, but we are pinned to shared values. And I think those values are openness, respect, compassion, a willingness to work hard, to be there for each other, to search for equality and justice. And I'm completely ripping this off of what Trudeau said, but I think that holds true. And I would add that, you know, we also have a commitment to free trade and to economic liberalization, which kind of goes hand in hand with multiculturalism. And that also extends to that idea of us being natural resource extractors and selling our products to the rest of the world. And it's interesting because I think we do think of ourselves as a very much capitalist state, but we pride ourselves on having the types of public services such as health and education, and even a commitment to social justice, which is, I think, right now being best epitomized by a commitment to reconciliation, at least in principle. And it's not to say that we're doing amazing on all those areas. It's just to say that most Canadians, at least most Canadians that I've met, largely subscribe to those ideas of what it is to be Canadian. So I think you're right in terms of Canadians, unlike Americans, not aggressively imprinting this idea of Canadian identity onto each other. And maybe our values are, you know, in the clouds, and they're super idealistic because we're not perfect. But I do think that we are crystallizing a certain Canadian identity, both in our politics and our expectations of what our community should look like.
I would definitely agree with all of that. And even to the point that we're a young state, we're, you know, compared to the United States, compared to many European states, we're maybe entering our adolescence. And I for myself, you know, I've hit that point of disillusionment in the fact that what I was taught in school in regards to Canada's history is not the entire and full truth. And this reckoning that mm-hmm. we're having that comes with reconciliation for some of the things that we've done, you know, the journalistic issues with when they called murdered and missing Indigenous women a genocide, which when I read that report and I thought, because I'm the type of person who read the whole report and said it was a genocide, I have no issue calling mm-hmm. it a genocide. And, you know, other than some journalists who are upset with the use of that word, I think that for us to mature, to become the more mature state, that we have to come to terms with some of the injustices that I myself, as you know, my ancestors, you know, the white people that I've been around, that we've been wholly ignorant to until recently.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. And that's a really good point in terms of how we look at things, how we perhaps do bear a lot of guilt of how this country was built, because that's in complete contrast to the United States. You know, the United States is not particularly, as far as I know, acknowledging the fact that there was literally a genocide in their founding, in the creation of the United States. Whereas we are broadening out definitions to not just have something like genocide applied to Germany, Nazi Germany, or Rwanda, or other cases throughout history that we've always viewed those as that's genocide, but recognizing that even turning a blind eye to structural injustice where people, and in this case, women are being murdered, that's also a form of genocide. And it's an interesting thing that you pointed out. And again, it's in contrast to the Americans. I do wonder how much of our identity is the fact that we're not American. Like, how much of that is embedded in how we see ourselves as Canadian?
It's kind of become more of a contrast for me as I've gotten older. I grew up in a time in the 80s where, you know, when I grew up in the 80s, it was the middle of the Cold War. I've written often mm-hmm. about this terror that I felt about the Cold War. And I always mm-hmm. kind of looked at the Americans not as a police force, but kind of as a protective older brother. As I've gotten older mm-hmm. and I've realized, I understand the reality of our relationship, that there's a mutually beneficial aspect to it, that, you know, there's a reason why they want to protect us. But I honestly think mm-hmm. that there was more feelings of being a neighbor. But I feel that as I've gotten older, that I'm happy to see the contrast, and I'm happy to point out the fact that, no, we're not Americans. Like mm-hmm. you said, we can kind of look at a more critical view of our history and understand, some of us can understand, you know, some of the pain we've inflicted, some of the bad things that we've done to get to this point. Not only that, not just to acknowledge it, but to kind of write it into our active history, that it's there, mm-hmm. that we're not hiding from it. And to me, that's a contrast to the Americans, but that's, you know, especially looking at across the border right now, watching the impeachment hearings, seeing how the divide between Republicans and Democrats, and I can sit up here and go, thank God we're not there. And yeah, you know what?
I think that's so Canadian. And it's interesting, you know, not to take away anything from your personal experience or how you've evolved in your thinking in terms of Canadians vis-a-vis Americans, but I actually think a lot of our identity is tied up into not being Americans. And you could argue that that goes as far back as the War of 1812. And in a lot of ways, you know, yes, we do view the United States as our big brother, but we sometimes even have like a superiority or maybe an inferiority complex.
Yeah,
with the
at
Americans.
The same time, we have this weird inferiority, moral superiority thing with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we make jokes about them. We clutch our pearls at what's happening down there, but we still have a lot of work to do here too. And certainly, you know, we don't have Trump as our head of state or as our leader in government. But if we consume so much American media, you know, we love their politics, we love their cities, love to travel there. If we're not identical to the Americans, I think we're certainly, you know, first cousins or siblings
But, for sure.
And I think it is a weird paradox that as much as we try to define ourselves as not Americans, we still have and share a lot of the cultural values that they have. But I was thinking about this question as well in preparation for this. And I think there are two things that separate us from Americans in terms of identity. And I think that first one is something I just alluded to, which is the multiculturalism, the tolerance, the respect, the idea of a cultural mosaic rather than a melting pot, right? That is something that is uniquely Canadian versus being an American. And the second thing is, and maybe you'll disagree with this, maybe some other people will disagree with this, I think we are fully embracing an idea of progressivism. You know, we were one of the first nations to bring in gay marriage. We were one of the first on marijuana legalization. Certainly much before the Americans. I mean, the Americans nationally have not legalized marijuana. And I think in this idea of like Western liberalism, you know, we're on the forefront for a lot of these things. Even this idea of, and again, there's work to be done, but at least in principle, the protection of marginalized or underrepresented groups. I think we pride ourselves on being on that forefront and ahead of a lot of countries, but most notably the United States.
I think that we have gotten a lot better confronting some of our, you know, when we see a racist act take place in the city of Toronto, I think mm-hmm. we're a lot better at understanding and accepting what happened and processing it than the Americans are, because it hasn't hit that point where it gets entirely political. Yes, we do have crazy racist things that happen in Canada, incredibly misogynistic mm-hmm. acts that happen. You know, you see a woman, you know, in mid like rant at a Starbucks. That happens in Canada too. I think that maybe we're mm-hmm. better at processing, we're better at accepting it, and maybe trying to find kind of a human approach to dealing with it rather than a political approach to dealing with it. And I think that's something that separates us. One thing I find that would always surprise me is that, you know, I grew up in Northern Ontario. I had, mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie, I held some fairly ignorant views when I was younger because I hadn't been around, I had not been immersed in a multicultural society. As I got older, I sure. moved away. I moved to Ottawa. I forced myself to, even at first, it was just dining. You know, I'm going to go to mm-hmm. an Indian restaurant. I've never been there. I'm going to go eat Ethiopian. And then you start meeting people. You start, my thinking evolves. But when I started going to the United States, because in Ottawa, we used to go down to like Watertown and Syracuse and places to go shopping sure. and do all that. And it shocked me that the more time I spent around Americans, other than this odd fascination with guns, I found that we were so like, that we could sit there, we could have conversations, and other than me saying A and being fully apologetic, which, you know, is more than a stereotype if you ask me, we were able to find common ground on so many issues that they appreciated us being there, they appreciated us neighbors, and mm-hmm. on a personal human level that we connect. I think that some of the issues on, you know, in government and issues, the bigger issues are what's separating us right now. But I just think that we're better at understanding our feelings than Americans are.
Yeah, and that's a fair assessment. And again, what I said was not to knock Americans on a personal level.
No, not at all.
My interactions with Americans in small towns or in big cities has largely been positive. And especially in small towns, and that might hold the truth here as well. In small towns, Americans are very accommodating, and they're very hospitable, and they're very charming. I'm speaking more on that structural level, and I think in a great example or a great contrast is the fact that you can have Don Cherry, and he says you people here, you come here, you enjoy your milk and honey, and the whole thing. And there was legitimate outrage, you know, and granted he had his defenders as well, but there was legitimate outrage, not just from Twitter, but from people calling in and calling that unacceptable. Whereas in the United States, I mean, you have talking heads who have daily shows who are saying arguably much worse things on a daily basis on a big network. And somehow that's tolerable. And I just don't know if that is tolerable here. I mean, we tried the Sun News experiment or whatever that was, and that didn't last very long. It couldn't attract viewership. It didn't bring in the resonance with Canadians the way that they thought it might be. But so on a structural level, I just think we are maybe a little more progressive. And I think what we're starting to see as a result of that, you are starting to see a backlash. You know, people are putting multiculturalism and economic liberalization in the same camp. And again, as I said, they are related. But you're starting to see this resentment come out from a changing global economy. You're starting to see this resentment come out from changing cities. And it's rearing its head in very ugly ways. Racism, homophobia, sexism. And I think the one thing that Canada really has to deal with, and again, maybe this goes back to the idea of us being natural resource extractors historically, is that there is going to be a lot of economic change as we continue into the modern economy. There's going to be economic displacement. There's going to be changing demographics. And there is a segment of the population who finds that very uncomfortable. And there's a segment of the population that is very angry about that.
Yeah, but those are the same people who are angry about liquor stores being open on Sundays too, though. Change happens, man. It does. And you know what?
No, for sure, but we can't exclude... I'm just saying we can't exclude those people from the conversation. It's very easy to shun them and, you know, completely ignore them. And in a lot of cases, you have to do that on a person-to-person level. But, you know, you look at what's happening with this whole Wexit thing, and... That is whatever said and done, a challenge to bring in this very angry mob of people back into the Canadian identity. I mean, it's unfathomable that in a country like Canada that enjoys relative peace, where certainly no group that is being in the Wexit movement is being marginalized or suppressed. They want to create a separatist movement, and how real that is, I don't know, but you are starting to see this creep into the mainstream. And I think that is concerning. And, you know, it brings up the question of why have we seen so much alienation throughout our country? You know, it's Western Canada now, it was Quebec before. Why do we see this happen?
Okay. Here's what I think. And it's probably going to piss some people off, but we didn't hear about Wexit.
I feel like I've already pissed a bunch of people off, so let's keep going.
I feel that my very existence on Twitter pisses people off, so let's just kick it up a notch. I think that Wexit was not heard about until the Liberals were reelected. If Andrew Scheer would have been elected, it would not have been a thing. I think that there's been a Western separatism movement for a long time. There was a Western Separatism Party in the 70s. I think during the National Energy Program that tensions were far higher. I think that this is a movement created by opportunists who are tapping into an anger that people who are seeing the world change before them and not understanding, they're scared and they feel fear, and they're being taken advantage of by people who are looking for relevance. And I think that, you know, we're, like you said, we have our Canadian economy, we have this multicultural economic liberalism, but the world is changing. And if we don't change with the world, we're going to be left behind by the world. And we have to find a way to bring the people who feel fear and who are upset and angry in. But I think they're being played for by fools, for a bunch of people who are looking for relevance, who are looking. I mean, if Andrew Scheer would have been elected, we wouldn't have heard about this. And so now what? Because because Canadians elected Justin Trudeau, that all of a sudden. No, it's just. But they're playing with fire, man. These people who are feeding these tensions are playing with fire. And I can't have sympathy. Yeah. I can't have sympathy for I have sympathy for the people who are left behind. I have sympathy for the people who are suffering, but I have no sympathy for the movement whatsoever.
And I completely agree with you. And I don't think that's too controversial. But I would add.
I moderated my words.
You don't go soft on me, Neil. Don't go soft on me.
Well, here's another thing.
I would just add to exactly what you're saying. I would just say but it is a problem for the governing Liberal government because they don't have a seat in that big swath of land. So they can't have a cabinet minister there. They can't have, you know, proper government representation there to even extend that olive branch. I mean, obviously they can, but not in the same way as if they had, you know, boots on the ground or a cabinet minister, influential people within caucus in there, in those communities, doing that work. It's a challenge for them as well, and it cuts both ways. And I think you're right. There's absolutely opportunism, especially when it comes to people that are talking about separation or Wexit. But as you noted, this feeling of Western alienation is not new. The feeling of Quebec's alienation is not new. And I think part of the reason that these things keep coming up and have persisted in our history, I think there's three reasons, actually. I think, first of all, distance. We're a huge country. I looked this up. We are 9,300 kilometers wide. And movement within the country is not cheap. It's very expensive. A flight from Vancouver to Halifax is quite expensive compared to the same type of distance that you can travel from anywhere within Europe. So I think that creates a certain regional disconnection. The second thing that I think creates alienation is effectively capitalism. When we talk about immigration, immigration's primary purpose is for labor and for capital to contribute and to grow the economy, because the people within the economy can't do it themselves. That's the base economic reasoning for immigration. Obviously, we have humanitarian needs and that sort of thing. But when we do now experience a changing economy and perhaps a shift away from resource extraction, who becomes the first target of blame? Well, it's immigrants. And then extended from immigrants is, okay, who's the government that's really promoting immigration? Well, it's in this case, the Trudeau government. And again, this is urban-rural tensions playing out. This is service sector economy versus natural resources playing out. And I think this has to be confronted somehow, because we are evolving. We might even be, some would argue, in our adolescence years, where we do have one idea of what our identity is, and then you have a progressive, forward-thinking movement saying, no, 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 our identity is this post-nation state, and this is what we are, and you have tensions between the two. The third thing why I actually think that there is alienation is that we are very moderate in our patriotism. And I don't think that patriotism is necessarily a bad thing. I know that some elements of the left want it to be. And I'm not talking about, you know, those MAGA assholes that have made patriotism gross. But I am a firm believer in patriotism because I love this country. But I think Canadians, for the most part, are pretty modest with their patriotism. Do you see that as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I've gone to, like, to football games in Buffalo, right, mm-hmm. to go see the Bills, there's people crying when the national anthem is playing. And it's a heartfelt, yeah. and it's a beautiful thing to see. I mean, they love their country, man. They wear it on their sleeves. And I don't know if it's Canadian modesty. You know, I feel extremely patriotic. But mm-hmm. you know what? I don't think we have the same connection to symbolism that Americans do. Like, you know, when we were talking about the Canadian identity, and I was thinking back to, this is going to be kind of an odd tangent, but I was thinking back to when I was a kid in the lake, right, in which we would go to, like, you know, there was a cottage, and we'd go there, and one day there was an ice storm the night before, mm-hmm. and it was, the whole lake was ice, and I remember I was able to skate for like 3 kilometers down this lake, and I remember,
oh wow,
and I was thinking of that, and I was thinking, to me, that was as Canadian as something that you can't do anywhere else in the world. But like you're saying, yeah. when it comes to patriotism, that Americans have an attachment to, I don't know if it's a symbolism of America or the idea of America. I just find that my patriotism is more inward. It's more, mm-hmm. it's more how I feel, as opposed to how I'm going to relate to that patriotism. you know, I'm not going to sit there when the Canadian national anthem is playing and you know, to be moved so to tears, unless, you know, someone wins a gold medal in the Olympics and I cry like a baby for some reason when the Canadian national anthem is played, but, you know, or the Raptors win, when you know, but, you know, it's not the same attachment. So to make a long answer short, I completely agree with what you're saying that, you know, we're a lot more modest in how we display our patriotism than our neighbors.
Sure. And then this creates this problem where, you know, the MAGA assholes of Canada, however you want to define them, they turn around and they say, oh, well, the reason why we're not patriotic is because we're so multiculturalist, and they blame multiculturalism. And they ignore the fact that, you know, people who immigrate here and who raise families here and work here and want to live the rest of their lives here, they love this place. And immigrants are just as patriotic as, you know, nationalized or citizens who are born here.
Just as much as I am. You know what?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't see myself as more Canadian than someone who came to Canada. I never have. That is something I've never felt. I don't know. I don't know if that's how a majority of people feel, but I've never viewed it that way.
Yeah, no, and that's because you're a good person and you're a reasonable person. But I think there is that undercurrent that sees it much differently, right? They view immigrants as leeches. And I mean, Don Cherry echoed a lot of this sentiment as well. Oh, they see people as, though they're just here to enjoy our good life, but they don't want to be Canadian or whatever that bullshit is. And it's wrong. And it's, again, it's scapegoating larger issues. It's scapegoating immigrants in the face of larger issues with regards to particularly economic displacement, but also just the fact that things are changing. We are heading into a modern world. We are a young country that's still developing an identity. You know, we don't even have the history that I'm talking about Canada as a nation, not the land, but Canada as a nation doesn't have the history that a European nation does, or that even to a certain degree, the Americans do. But on the topic of patriotism, and I've discussed this on my podcast as well, I almost get the idea that if you want to make it big in Canada, you almost have to get validation in the United States and then come back. You know what I mean? Like, we don't, and I find this particularly in Vancouver. I don't know if Toronto's the same way, but I find that, you know, we have so much talent in so many different fields, but to almost be recognized as like a great Canadian, they need external validation. And I wonder if that plays into our inferiority complex or what that's about.
Well, yeah, you know, we're like a mosquito sleeping beside an elephant, right? we got to be ready to fly when they decide they're going to roll over. But
yeah,
I mean, you know, when I was younger, that's how I viewed things, right? But then at a certain point that, you know, when I became involved in my campus radio station and I started reading a lot more, I started paying attention to kind of the wider and broader world around me, that I started seeking out Canadian entertainment, Canadian bands. Like the earlier on, I was interviewing Dave Bedini. He runs the West End Phoenix in Toronto. He's in a band called Rheostatics, who nobody, maybe other than patrons of the bars that they played in the United States, has ever heard of. But bands like that have been able to carve out an identity in Canada. And, you know, I think that, you know, when people talk about the Tragically Hip, well, I may not, I loved some of their music. For me, it was the fact that they stayed in Canada. They found their fame in Canada. And I think they gave a blueprint to a lot of artists to do the same. And I'm hoping that's one of those trends that change, that you're not going to recognize an actor until you see him in an American movie. I mean, Quebec does it well. If you've been to Quebec, their movie industry and music industry is so incredibly like native to their province, and it's flourishing. Their movie industry is crazy. And if you look at the talent, like Denis Villeneuve and some of these directors and some of these musicians, like Montreal, like Arcade Fire and Stars and all these bands that have, I think you know, I was trying to explain this to my daughter, that when I was growing up, that we were happy when we won a bronze medal in the Olympics. We were happy that when we had a band that would appear on Saturday Night Live. And we now have a thriving movie, music industry, arts. And I just hope that with the maturation of Canada that we were discussing earlier, that it means that there's going to be maybe more, I guess, artistic patriotism that we feel, I guess.
I hope so. And, you know, another great example of what I'm talking about is that show Schitt's Creek, right? Like, it was a CBC show, but then suddenly it gets on Netflix and it blows up in the U.S. And now suddenly all of my friends are watching the show. And admittedly, I've never seen it, but I was thinking, I was like, oh, the CBC show? Like, we're, and I'm a victim to this as well in terms of not appreciating the local or the Canadian talent that we have here. But that show blew up after it was taken onto Netflix. Heartland is another one. You know, Heartland was kind of this middling show on the CBC. They put it on Netflix and became this global phenomenon. And,
or even,
you know,
Kim's Convenience too, you know,
what's that?
Even Kim's Convenience, you know, that started out as a play, a one man play, right? In at the Toronto Fringe Festival. And it, to me, it's a brilliant show. I mean, I absolutely love it. And, you know,
so why can't we get on the program before it blows up? Like, I don't think Schitt's Creek or Kim's Convenience, maybe Kim's Convenience, that might be a separate show, but I don't think Schitt's Creek or Heartland was as big in Canada until it was like validated through Netflix. You know what I mean? Like, it could have been a bigger thing. None of my friends had watched it until it was on Netflix. And maybe that's something to do with distribution or whatever, but I do wonder how much of that is that we need external validation from the United States in terms of culture. Because as I said, most of the culture that we consume in Canada, at least in where I live in Vancouver and in metropolitan cities, I presume, is culture from the U.S.
Well, you got that, you know, beautiful,
it's not homegrown stuff.
You have that beautiful chandelier under an overpass, right? You can maybe take a loved one down there for a nice dinner, you know, underneath the chandelier. I mean, that's Canadian culture.
Yeah, I mean, you opened up a can of worms with that chandelier. You know, I've been ragging on that thing for weeks now, but. Sure. Yeah, that's that. The juxtaposition between the ultra wealthy and the completely marginalized under a bridge in Vancouver. Sure, that is indicative of at least Vancouver's culture.
That's a bad example, I guess. But no, I mean, but even as you,
we do have great artists, though. No, you're absolutely right. You know, fuck the chandelier. We do have a lot of great artists here, and I think they need to be elevated. And whether that does, and obviously, you know, the government does funding for the arts, and I'm not an expert to comment on that, but I think that's a good thing. I absolutely do think that the governments in Canada, both federal and provincial and local, need to fund local artists, because there is just as much talent here on a per capita basis as there is anywhere else in the world.
Exactly. I thought that chandelier was some kind of Banksy joke at first thought, to be honest with you. Remember you sent me the article on that this one from Vice about it. And I honestly thought it was like some kind of, oh, Banksy, what did he do now?
You know what? If that's the funny thing about art. And that's the funny thing about that chandelier that they made. So for people who do not know, there is a public art installation of a beautiful chandelier underneath the Granville Street Bridge in Vancouver. And people hate it because right now in Vancouver, there's a lot of economic disparity between the ultra wealthy and, forget, you know, the people on the bottom, but even just the people in the middle. So the interesting thing about the chandelier hanging underneath this bridge is that if it was made by a Banksy or like ultra leftist type to point out this widening economic gap, people would have been like, oh my God, this is so brilliant. But the fact that it's funded by a real estate developer, one of the most infamous real estate developers in Vancouver, a real estate developer that openly says, hey, we're building luxury condos and we're just going to sell them overseas. Like, we're not really building for Vancouver, but we are going to add to the skyline and we are going to be iconic or whatever however they describe themselves. The fact that it was funded by them really upset a lot of people, myself included, because that money that they used to purchase and to put up that art installation, that was actually money that was negotiated with the city, and it could have been used in other services. It could have been used in amenities, community amenities. And in one way, it's good that, you know, the city says, okay, if you're going to build a tower, we need some public art. But in another way, it's really shitty when the public art is basically a middle finger to the entire city.
Yeah. How, why can't it be like, here, we'll let you build this tower, but, you know, 10% of it has to be affordable housing. I frankly, when I saw that, that's kind of what I was confused about. Like, that's great, but that was completely inappropriate in my opinion. And like I said, at first I thought it was a Banksy thing, and that would have been amazing. Like that time when that his painting was auctioned and it shredded itself. Like, I thought that, like, you know what? Hopefully this chandelier will shred itself at some point.
I feel like you're going to see a lot of shoes.
I know, man.
Tied and hanging from that chandelier.
If I was a teenager, I'd be laying down under the pellet gun, which is how we dealt with streetlights.
And I'm not advocating for that. I'm certainly not advocating for the destruction of public property, but the fact that it's so brazenly offensive to people, this is going to happen for sure.
But I'm not saying I want anything to happen to, but if it happened to fall down the flight of the stairs, well, you know, I might look the other way and have a bit of a snicker, but I just think that that was just so Vancouver. Right when I saw
it was
that,
very Vancouver.
When I saw that, I actually thought of you. I'm like, I wonder what he thinks about this. I'm sure I do.
I was fuming. I'm still fuming. Yeah. I'm still upset about it.
Which is why I brought it up, right? Which is why I brought it up. Pull that bandaid off. And you know, so, about, you know, just to
yeah, go ahead.
Bring it back into a circle. It's funny, you know, you brought up the Don Cherry thing, and we in our in our group had some interesting conversations, and I thought one of the best points was made by my daughter was that when she saw it, she said, you know, I found that I'm a huge hockey fan. I play hockey. I played hockey throughout my life. I've kind of hit the point, you know, after I'm kind of slowing down, even in my watching it. But I've always felt it's been tolerated in the house, not appreciated, which I'm fine with. But when I said, what do you think of this? And she said, well, it's a stupid thing for him to have said, but I don't give a shit about who Don Cherry is. And it's funny because I was on the bus that night, and that's not when these Jacob Wall, I was sitting in a liberal coffee shop and I heard this, but I was sitting in transit that night. I decided not to put my earbuds in, and I heard these three 18-year-old boys talking about it. And I thought for sure that they were going to take his side, but they all seemed to agree with the fact that it was offensive and that, you know, I enjoyed Don Cherry when I was 10, but now that I'm 17 and I'm much more mature, well, I find it
so much more mature.
Yeah, and that's what I said. That's a microcosm of this whole thing. And I thought that, you know what, my anger would more stem from the fact that he's had a career of saying these horrible things. And I was able to just, it was like a spring coming out of a can when that happened. All this shit that he said over the years, all these things that I found offensive, well, you know what? It's time to bring these things back up and to make sure that people know this. And I didn't suffer anyone who was trying to defend him. Anyone who's trying to defend him on my timeline, I just shut it down and said, listen, this can go one of two ways. It's going to end up with me blocking you. You can admit that while you like Don Cherry, what he said was offensive, that there's no place for it anymore. All he had to do was say he was sorry and he'd have a job still. Instead, he went to Tucker Carlson. I'm glad he's gone. It's time to send that guy to the dustbin of history. You know, there's some causes that he followed were good. He's always been pro safety in hockey. There is a legacy that maybe we can review, but I'm glad he's gone. And that kind of sums up Don Cherry for me.
I think that's just it. I mean, again, his history and what he was saying that is now offensive. I mean, he just didn't change with the times, and it's not to say that Don Cherry is 100% evil. He's certainly also done some good things.
Oh, yeah.
But he has not evolved with the times, and that what he said was completely inappropriate. And you know, you bring up those kids in a coffee shop. I love Gen Z, man. I think Gen Z is so cool in terms of they look at things and they go, why are you guys doing it this way? Wait, why do you think that? Wait, how come you're not prioritizing the climate? Like some people might say it's a certain naivete, but I think it's a certain, for lack of a better word, a certain wokeness that Gen Z has in terms of how they look at things, because that generation has been exposed to so much more than any other generation that preceded it because of technology, because of the internet. They are much more aware of what's happening in the world, and they're exposed to it from a very young age. They're, you know, even when I was growing up, my exposure to what was happening in the world was the 6 o'clock news, because my dad would watch it, and the newspaper, because we'd get that delivered. And I saw my dad reading the newspaper every morning, so I was reading the newspaper every morning. But that was it. But that's nothing compared to what they're seeing on the internet, whether that's YouTube or just news sites or Twitter or even TikTok. I mean, the fact that TikTok is politicized, and it's politicized almost exclusively by people in Gen Z, and of course Jagmeet Singh, is amazing. It's really cool. And I think that generation gives me a lot of hope. I hope they continue with their values and idealism, because I think we need that pressure, and I'm always all about questioning things. You know, questioning why we do certain things, why we tolerate certain things, why we can't change certain things. And I think Gen Z really encapsulates that. They're amazing kids.
And it also
helps. And they show they were pointed in the right direction.
No, and I see them out on, you know, in front of schools striking for the climate. In Ontario, mm-hmm. they were striking for sex education. They're so much more mm-hmm. engaged than I was at that age. But a lot of it just kind of helps me illustrate how deeply unhip I've become. You say TikTok and I go like, what the fuck is that? And
I'm not on TikTok. I've only read about it.
I can just deal with Twitter, man, at this point. And You know, like Facebook is good to find out that the people you thought who were douchebags in high school are still douchebags, and which of your relatives sure. who become full-on racists. my wife's on it, and she's angry all the time about it. And I'm okay with just Twitter, but it's just I've hit that point now where I'm just not hip anymore, and I feel like that Steve Buscemi, not Adam Sandler movie. Hey kids, want to rap? You know, like.
Hello, fellow kids.
Fellow kids. You know, I feel like that when I'm talking to my daughter, she'll just look at me, and now I'll just say things to make her angry, like catchy things. Like she'll be like, "How's your day?" And I'll be, "It's lit." And she'll just like, "Oh my god, stop it!" Or I'll drop her off at school, and she'll see you later, and I'll be like, "YOLO," and she'll be like, "Oh, shut up! Like, don't say things like that."
When we look at this generation of kids, and we look at how we grew up, and you're slightly older than me, but you know, we still share a lot of the same hallmarks of our growing up in Canada. Do you think hockey is as symbolic for the next generation of kids and the next generation as it was for us? Because I feel like hockey was very core to Canadian identity. Like the fact that it was like a cold winter sport, the fact that it's like, it's tough and rugged in a way, like,
yeah,
the fact that fighting is allowed in hockey is pretty fucked up.
Yeah,
could you imagine a tennis game where they just sanctioned fighting?
Why wouldn't some dude in a bar and be like, "Let's drop him"? And
you
get arrested for that shit, man. In hockey, it just happens. And no, I think the basketball is going to overtake hockey. I think that this, if hockey doesn't change, like the NBA has been amazing at letting their stars. Letting their personalities kind of take over the game, letting their, you know, especially the
racial. Except in China.
Oh, yeah, I mean, let's forget about that. One tweet basically starts, but besides the point though, like it's racialized players who are able to be themselves and to bring their culture into the sport, and the sport gets better because of the people. Like you're talking about the mosaic. The times I've been to NBA games, I have an absolute blast. There's music playing in the periphery. You know, there's athletic things that I can still strap on skates. And, you know, I'm not fast like an NHLer, but I can relatively do some of the things that, you know, anyone who plays hockey can do some of the things that they, but I can't jump from the top of the key and slam dunk a basketball. I jump from the top of the key, I'll fly 5 feet and probably break my ankle. But, you know, I think, though, that seeing what the Raptors did this year, the NHL and hockey in general has to be worried about that, because you look at the amount of Canadian talent that's entering the NBA. I feel that I feel that basketball and soccer, because of the relative inexpense of playing those sports compared to hockey.
Yeah, that's true.
I believe that at the grassroots level, you're going to see a bit of a change there. And I think that if the Don Cherry thing has done anything, it's shown hockey that they're going to have to change with the times. They're going to have to become.
What do you think the pitfalls are, at least from our generation's perspective, when we consider the fact that hockey was so rooted to our national identity?
For me, I think hockey at one time was absolutely everything. And, you know, I'm a lifelong Leafs fan, and I still am. I've tried to like other teams. I just can't. But I found when it came to hockey and it came to other things, that hockey is still important, but its importance relative to what's happening, that's relative to what's happening in my life, has gotten a lot smaller. And
yeah, and that's just age as well, though, right?
But it's also, I think, though, that that's a microcosm for hockey itself. It's going to have to change. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to change with the times. I just think that the fighting and some of these purposeful, like, taking shots at people's heads, and I think that they're going to have to change somewhat. Yes, violence is going to be part of the game, but I think they're going to have mm-hmm. to change, because there's a changing demographic right now in Canada, and hockey's going to have to change with it, or it's going to, you know, it's going to, I mean, in Canada, it's always going to be our national sport, but I feel it may, I feel that there may be kind of a reckoning for, you know, the pecking order that it sits at right now.
Sure. You know, one of my favorite, if not my favorite, political commentator is Nora Loretto. I don't necessarily agree with... Sorry?
Me too. I think she's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I don't necessarily agree with everything that she says, but, you know, she has a lot of guts to say the things that she does, and she provokes thought and she provokes conversation. And she's clearly saying something important, because it really upsets people. You look at the hate that she gets. You know, people don't give that type of hate to just some crazy person. They give it to someone who they view as a threat to their identity and their way of life. And, you know, she's been very vocal about pointing out the fact that hockey culture in this country has, in our lifetime, you know, been rooted in things like sexism and homophobia and racism and abuse.
Rape,
you know,
culture.
Abuse is a big thing. Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the pitfalls of tying a sport to your identity, I mean, we've all seen the beer commercials and the Molson Canadian commercials, but when you tie a sport to your national identity, it's easy to think that, you know, someone that's good at that sport, in this case hockey, is just a good person. And as we're starting to learn, that's not true. And when you grow up idolizing someone and thinking the world of them just because they're good at hockey, and then you realize that, oh, they might be a terrible person, it's really difficult to reconcile. And I think that's the one pitfall of tying something like hockey to your national identity, because you're not tying it to values. You're tying it to being good or having a skill at this one thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I agree with Nora that she runs right into the storm. You know, I admire that about her. I don't agree with everything she said, but I believe mm-hmm. that she is someone who gives her opinion without fear, and it's mm-hmm. admirable. And you watch the people she upsets, like the Warren Kinsellas and kind of this white ivory tower of journalism that seems to be upset at her constantly. And then, of course, mm-hmm. you know, the lunatic fringe who, I mean, if you look at one of her tweets and reading the comments on it, it is almost soul destroying.
It's really sad. And it's, you know, I do wonder if she was a male commentator, how much people would call her, you know, this rogue philosophical thinker and point them in this bad boy type light or whatever. And I don't think she gets painted in that light when she should be. She's absolutely, for lack of a better word, a maverick in terms of thinking, in terms of digesting information in a way that people can understand and getting you to think. And again, I don't have to agree with her on every single thing that she says, but man, when she says something, it's not just provocative for the sake of being provocative. It's true intellectualizing and questioning ideas and being critical of them. And we need more of that in this country. And it doesn't mean that you don't love this country. It doesn't mean that you're not a quote unquote patriot. It means that you care. And it means that you are trying to build a certain future that you think will be best for the next generation. And that is somewhat, I mean, I've privately DM'd with Nora. I am such a big fan. And I wish we had more of that in this country. I think we're so meek and mild-mannered when you look at some of the discourse that we have. And then not only meek and mild-mannered, the guys that are being shallow or the guys that are being controversial come off as really shallow. You know, yeah. They're not talking about real issues. So I think the way that she broke open this hockey Canadian identity, toxic masculinity conversation, she was the one that broke it open. I mean, she's been talking about this for years.
Yep.
And now finally people are starting to confront it. And it's like, hey, she was on the forefront of it and you called her a loon and you called her all these nasty things and condoned, you know, the treatment she was getting. But she was ahead of the curve before any of us were.
Yeah. And if Nora Loretta was a man, she'd be hosting a show on the CBC. She'd be hosting a show on the CBC and she'd have a biweekly national column in the Globe. And,
yeah,
you know, that's just, it's one of those things, you know what, it's just as good of a time to kind of wrap it up, but to say that
Sure. That's
what we have to kind of achieve. That's what we have to strive towards. We have to, mm-hmm. You know, it's just a thing with Evan Solomon who did great, like whatever, he's a nice guy. I don't really know anyone who dislikes him on a personal level, but we keep recycling these journalists. Like someone posted this picture of all the new faces hires at all the columnists at the Globe, and they're all white people. And you know, I'm not one of those white people who goes like, oh man, like we have it too good. I'm just saying that there wasn't a racialized face on it. And
yeah,
I think that one of the things that we're going to have to strive towards is we're going to, if we want our media to be great, if we want the discourse to improve, if we need to put worthy journalists in proper positions, we have to give opportunities to the voices out there, to the authors, to the musicians who are truly making a difference, who are being progressive, who are bringing new ideas to the table. That's what we have to strive towards. We have to make sure that the Nora Loretto's aren't podcasting, which I thoroughly enjoy her podcast, but she should have, people like her should have, I hate saying that. I mean, journalist as talented as Nora should have a platform in which to show it off, in which we all can see it. And we can all, whether we disagree or agree, that it has to get out there. It's like the National Observer. Some of their authors are absolutely amazing. And I gladly support that. But yeah, that's kind of my thing now is we have to bring talent back into Canadian journalism or else we're doomed. We're heading to what CNN is right now, which is.
So how's this? I'm gonna give you your 2020 resolution. I have an idea for you, Neil. You love to be very critical of media. So when you see a shit piece, you call it out for what it is on Twitter. It's amazing. You get all the likes, you get all the kudos for that. So how about this? Next time that you want to slam a John Kay article or whoever else, you pause for a second and you go, you know what? Instead of slamming this one article, I'm going to give platform to another article that I actually think is brilliant.
Yeah, no, and I think that I'm going to have to give equal platform to equal criticism.
It's very easy to dump on all the shitty stuff that's out there in the Canadian media, but there's a lot of Canadian media that's not getting its shine, and it's amazing.
I agree, and last week I It was funny. Max Fawcett wrote that piece about proportional representation, and I posted it. And I didn't realize, man, sometimes when you kick the proportional representation bee's nest, you know, people that have followed me for years are kind of jumping on me. And I'm going, I agree with Max about the ranked ballot because it's something that's it's something that we can do. It's achievable. Mm-hmm. But you know what? You're right. You're right. You know what? Like at the start of this year, I didn't know anyone was paying attention to what I had to say. Then I found out the hard way that people were. And I think that I've evolved somewhat. I've tried to modulate my language. I've tried to maybe to bring as much positivity as negativity. It hasn't worked particularly, but I agree that that's something that I'm going to work towards is giving platform to good journalism.
And Neil, I was not throwing shade at you whatsoever. Oh, no, I
don't think so.
You have a huge platform. People love you. And I try to do this in my own Twitter as well. I mean, listen, it's great when you dunk on someone and you dunk on someone in the media. It's really funny. But I also try to uplift voices, and especially people who I've communicated with or maybe even I've met. So I'm always pushing stuff by Max Fawcett or Nora Loretto or anyone else, you know, that I think is doing a great job. And I have a very small platform, but I do want to focus more on pushing out those positive voices as opposed to just ripping down, the garbage that we see, because there's so many people already doing that.
It's too easy to dunk on Rex Murphy. Like it really is. And you're right. I, you know what? I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. I'm going to need you to check me on that stuff though. You're gonna have to
Other. Okay. We're in it. We're going to be accountability buddies.
I had fun dunking on that red pill guy with you a few weeks ago.
Which red pill guy?
That's
was
a
this?
Guy who you made the comment about the poppy, and he's one of those men's rights guys.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of my best burns ever. And I said, when he said, wow, that's good. And I'm like, I dropped the mic, but the idiot would probably try and fetch it.
And then he blocked me. MRAs are so weird. Me. Yeah.
Boom. I just have to say that comment.
Well, and he blocked you. Yeah. He got real snowflakey with you.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you're able to just, but that was fun. But I find, you know, like before, I used to argue with every person who made a negative comment. And I've learned now not to read my comments. Unless I get a notification from someone I know, I don't read my comments anymore. Yeah. I don't because, I think 2020 is going to see a kinder, gentler Neil.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, still kind of an asshole, but kinder though.
Don't get too gentle. Don't get too soft.
Yeah, still kind of an asshole, but you know what? A nicer asshole.
No. I'm just saying there's a balance and it's again, to bring it all together, I feel like we've had five endings right now, but to bring it all together. Yeah. You know, when it comes to Canadian identity and when it comes to not having to seek external validation, you know, let's support our own. And that starts locally. That's starts at going to local shows, local cultural events, being out in your community. But then on a national level, that also includes supporting people that you think are doing a good job and just looking out a little more, because there's so much talent in this country. And I think so much talent is being unappreciated in this country that we need to start building some of these really great stars, especially in the media.
Yeah. And that's what we'll do, man. We are going to be a two-person friggin' great journalism platform.
You're carrying the bigger load than I am. You have a much bigger platform.
Well,
than me,
so. I think
we'll do it together. Though.
Now with FU politics and all that, though, I really think that we have an opportunity. You know, I want to make the most of this, and that's what kind of this podcast for me is like, you know, Zodcast 2.0, because you know, I like this just talking about not coming in and having to talk about election, having to talk about politics per se, but maybe talking about more wider picture things. So you know what, it's been a pleasure, Mo. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for rapping with me, man.
No, absolutely. Anytime, Neil. I feel like we covered some important ground. We didn't solve anything, but I feel like we should do it again. So let me know when you're available, and we will absolutely light it up again.
And I'm going to go against being Canadian, say I make no apologies about it, but I am sorry. All right.
Thank you, Neil. Later.
Resistance is not only about opposing a political party or ideal that you disagree with, it's about holding the politicians and political parties that you support to account.
While the Conservative Party has its little civil war over Andrew Scheer's leadership, we have to put partisanship aside and ensure that Liberal government is following through on the promises made to us. This is not a one-sided arrangement, and my support is not blind. Let's find a way to constructively hold Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and our government to account. Also, let's remember to look for journalism that challenges us and support independent papers like Dave Bedini's West End Phoenix by subscribing and promoting it. Amazing journalism exists. Make sure to seek it out and give it whatever platform we can. I would like to thank Dave Bedini for taking the time to talk to me. It is not often that we get to speak with those who we admire, and this is one of those opportunities. Thank you for letting me excerpt Introducing Happiness from the Rheostatics double live album, which has stayed in constant rotation for me for close to 20 years. Thank you to This Is Van Colors' Mo Amir for an engaging and lively conversation. Make sure to subscribe to This Is Van Color wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, or compliments, reach out to me on Twitter at WaitWhichNeil. For any complaints, you can find me on Twitter at Linda Frum. Thank you for listening.
Kneel before Zeus!